Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, also perhaps known as or thought about films from the VHS era, though not necessarily on VHS, such as today's feature. And our film for this episode is Single White Female from 1992, and we have it on Laserdisc, buying it this summer from Assumption Records in Riseville, West Virginia.
That's absolutely. It was yes. Part of our haul from them.
Yes.
And if you don't know what Laserdisc is, it looks like a giant CD.
Yeah, a giant record-sized CD.
Yes.
And it uses lasers, so it's the technology of the future.
It is the technology of the future. And actually, we had a friend visiting, and they commented on what the actual retail value was in the 90s.
Yes, what looks like it might have been a rental copy, because there is a dust sleeve on it with a number. But yes, it has a remnant of the original price sticker on it. It was, in 1992, $13.95. Which adjusted for inflation was,
I think it was like $20-$25 for it.
No, there's $34 in 1992.
Oh.
Is close to $70 today.
Oh wow, sorry about that.
That's okay. So it's close to, somebody paid the equivalent of $70 to own a copy of Single White Female. And we should probably talk about why that is. Maybe we'll start with critical reception, do we really need to do a plot summary for this one? Because I think the shorthand, I think everybody, I never saw the movie before, actually. This was my first screening of Single White Female in the year 2021, but I knew exactly what the movie was about. I mean, it was shorthand, there were Saturday Night Live skits, and yeah. I dare say, and now having seen...
There's been tons of, like, remakes or...
Remakes of it, and yeah. I dare say, like, I had used the phrase to describe any sort of stalky behavior without seeing the film, and certainly without seeing the film in this contemporary context, and I might never use that phrase again. Honestly. And we'll talk about that, too. But yeah, basically, woman needs a roommate... Roommate, little psycho, the end. Like, that's, you got it.
Well, I also think it's interesting because there is like this trend that happens in horror films and even with fairy tales. It's like, you better stay on the right path, and if you don't, bad things are going to happen to you.
Yes.
So the funny thing about this is, Allison or Allie Jones, is a successful businesswoman. She's a software programmer, played by Bridget Fonda, who was on the top of her game at this point in time.
Yes.
Obviously has, like, a successful career, but, like, messes things up with her fiancé.
Well, doesn't she? She's not the one who messes up.
Well, but I feel like it's almost in some ways, like, she's punished for not
forgiving him for sleeping with his ex.
Yeah. Like, in some ways, it's like, because...
She didn't forgive him for his infidelity.
Yeah, it feels like in some ways that because she just didn't immediately get back with him and marry him, that she was almost punished for that transgression of not doing the normative thing, which would have been to be like, oh, it's no big deal that you slept with your ex-wife.
I forgive you.
We're still in love.
Yeah. And so this movie also, I mean, not only did it become sort of cultural shorthand for stalkiness, but, you know, in a weird way in 1992, it was a prestige suspense picture. It maybe, you know, is the long arm, the reach of the long arm of Alfred Hitchcock in terms of people's cinematic literacy.
Yeah.
And in 1992, this movie was kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a relatively successful film. It cost $16 million to make. It made $84 million. So it was successful. It did well.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, even Roger Ebert liked it.
Yes, and he said it redeemed the slasher genre.
Yep. And Jennifer Jason Leigh got an MTV Movie Award for Best Villain. So, I mean, come on.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, at that time, that would have been huge. to get the MTV Movie Award for Best Villain at that time.
Yes.
For that. And so there was a lot of, you know, interest in it. There, you know, people were rating it and giving it good feedback. But it's like sloppy psychological, right? Like,
well, I think for me, it's an example of, and yeah, there's a way that this film, when we talk about watching it in the 2020s, is this also just an example of how people's cinematic literacy has gotten better and more sophisticated over the decades?
Yeah.
Again, thinking there was a time when people thought Brian De Palma was a great director.
And this for
and
me,
if you lived in that era and you're like, yeah, man, Brian De Palma, which Brian De Palma would always get a good review from Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, this is a great movie. But to having seen other films and even just seeing, you know, again, me working with young people, their baseline, they've only been watching movies for 18 years, not even 18 years, maybe 14, 15 of those 18 years. I'm sure this movie would have some kitsch value more than anything to some of them.
No, you're right. I mean, it does have a Dress to Kill vibe. And some of those, you know, when you look at some of the Brian De Palma films, they're just schlocky. Like, that's what they are.
And I think this is, too. I mean, the thing that I wrote all down in my notes, and especially the first third of the film, the real exposition part of the film, is I wrote in big letters, all caps on my notebook, overt subtlety. Mm-hmm. There are, like, the target audience for this film is people who want to feel smart because they get it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. There's all of these, like, lingering shots on, you know, them, their faces, the glances they give each other, a hand gesture. There's all of, hey, hey, you see that? You see that? You see that? You see that? There's something going on here. Like, that is the whole, I mean, you just almost get like that guy wearing Birkenstocks with black socks, you know, going to the restaurant and going, that's how they get you, you know. I mean, there's, that's the person who would enjoy this film. Oh, I think there might be some sort of same-sex attraction happening here. I don't know about that, Hetty. She seems kind of weird.
So do you think,
you know what I
like
mean? Like, that is throughout the first third of the film. It just punches you in the face with, look how subtle I'm being. I am being so subtle right now. You have no idea how sophisticated it is, and you are part of the special super smart people's club for understanding what's happening in this movie.
So you're saying it's like a degree of mansplaining that's
happening. There's a degree of mansplaining. I mean, so, it's also reminiscent of, for what I think is the most disgusting scene in the history of cinema, which is the Nicole Kidman speech in The Others, where you're shown what's happened. There's a twist in that movie, and you're shown it. And then, obviously, in a test screening or whatever, people are like, what just happened? I was looking at my phone or something. Right before, this is before phones. People were just, I'm too stupid to follow a narrative. And so then she has to explain what we just saw for the people in the back. This movie's for the people in the back.
So the director, Barbette Schroeder, is a prestige director. So he actually is an Iranian-born Swiss film director who worked with Jean-Luc Godard, right? So he worked with Godard. And then prior to this, of what American filmmakers would know or should know, he did Barfly, which got a lot of prestige.
Yeah.
It's probably one of Mickey Rourke's best performances. He also did Reversal of Fortune, which, again, was a well-received film. It was nominated, you know, so you have him, he has these like really two strong films prior to Single White Female, plus he has the pedigree of working with
Godard,
right? So I think that also happens sometimes, is like that people are, you know, you get a pedigree and there's the assumption that no matter what they put it out, it's of quality and it must be a great
Yeah,
film.
It's that author function. Yeah. You know, it's, again, I mean, you know, it happens, well, in everything.
Yeah.
You know, Stephen King tested it in the Bachman books. Doris Lessing tested it, you know, where she released the same books under an assumed name. I mean, let's face it. If Bruce Springsteen put out, or Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan put out an album of Hungarian folk songs, but only the only instrument they made was used was like fart noises made with their hands. People go, wow, this is a Rolling Stone would give that 3.5 stars. Rolling Stone would give that 3 out of 4 stars. The Hungarian fart sound record by Dylan or Springsteen.
Right, well, I mean, even right now with Tarantino, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was not great.
He forgot to make a movie.
But it still got a lot of accolades for it.
Yes.
But anyway, the funny part about it for me is that, so the film opens with her sitting with Sam. Her fiance, who was played by Steven Weber, no one remembers Steven Weber anymore, but he did a show called Wings in the 90s.
Yes.
But Steven Weber, at that time, would have been the more known name.
Yeah.
But Bridget Fonda, and then, of course, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who is the breakout star of that film. But it starts with Allie, with Bridget Fonda's character, actually overhearing her fiance, Sam, talking with his ex-wife, and they had slept together. And so she breaks up with him. And her solution, though it's rent-controlled and that she can obviously afford the apartment herself, is that to get over him, she should get a roommate.
And also she has this financial need because her client, who's played by Ned the Head from...
Ned Ryerson.
Ryerson from...
Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day. Is manipulates her into severely undercutting her price because she is desperate for work. So she does have a financial need. I guess that's the other thing that happens in this film that's sort of interesting and is reminiscent of the famous Laura Mulvey essay, which is a little quaint now for some people, Visual Pleasure in Narrative Cinema, mm-hmm. where basically she talks about how the cinematic gaze, the cinematic look, teaches us how to look. Mm. And oftentimes we are... And it's a feminist piece, so it's this idea that, you know, we watch men watch women in movies and we learn how to watch women and what women should look like and what women should be.
Right.
And so the thing that happens in this film is there is a lot of voyeurism.
Yeah.
You know, we see Jennifer Jason... Or, I'm sorry, we see Bridget Fonda have sex with her... With Sam, her fiancé. There's this whole thing about the ductwork in the building that you see, you know... You can hear everybody else having sex at night. You have these moments when Hetty moves in, where she is very open with her body, and there's scenes in the bathroom, and there's scenes with her getting changed, and there's scenes with her stripping, and there's even a masturbation scene. And there's all these ways that we are in on, let's look at the private lives of these people, and let's look at these sexy people, which maybe that's why somebody spent $74 in adjusted for inflation on this laser disc.
Yeah.
So that, you know, you can have that voyeurism thing that's happening. But that leads us to the big problem with the film, the gay panic.
Yeah.
Aside from the somewhat sloppiness, aside from the ways that our cinematic literacy has evolved since, is there is a gay panic element as Hetty, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, becomes obsessed with Bridget Fonda and falls in love with Bridget Fonda and will literally stop at nothing
for them to be together.
Even
to the point that she cuts her hair and dyes it and starts wearing her clothes and buys clothes that match
hers and tries to assume her identity and, you know, kills a couple people.
Along the way. Though there is that great kill with a stiletto.
So yes, there's a great stiletto kill in Single White Female, which is slightly redemptive. But
I will say this, Allison character is kind of interesting because in, you know, 1992, you'd almost say that she was a little butch by how, like, her haircut and how she dressed. The one thing that I found really interesting is that when she, and the character's name is not Ned Ryerson, it's just that's who I know him as.
That's what we all know him as. And he plays a total sleazebag.
He does.
He plays a total, Ned the Head, what goes from being awkward to being just a monster. And our dog is so jumping on my crotch.
It was
and sniffing
Mitch,
the microphone.
Mitchell is the name of the character. So she has a meeting with Mitchell, and she. It sounds like though that if I remember correctly, she has just broken up with her female business partner.
Yes.
And a part of breaking up with the female business partner is that she got the rent-controlled apartment in the breakup. Isn't that weird? Like, so
that's weird, yeah.
So when I had to think about that, and I was like, why would if you broke up with your female
again, I think this
partner,
is part of the sloppiness of
would
it.
Would you get
and,
the
yeah? And she suddenly has a bad reputation, and
unless you had the, I guess I'm assuming they had the apartment together, so that like is odd, right? So there is like a kind of this kind of question mark about Allie, and then she brings in Hedra as her roommate. But at the beginning, when she's interviewing roommates, she's taking photos of all of her roommates as they're going through. And we just read this article about how she actually seems to reject the female candidates who seem butch.
Yes.
Right? And so there is one character who is like, this is a great apartment, we could build cabinets, you know, kind of thing. And she seems to reject any female candidate who kind of seems
is queer, is non-standardly female.
And Hedra,
you know, in her, especially as we first meet her, her meekness, her shyness, there's a vulnerability to her. I think at one point, Bridget Fonda's character says, oh, well, she doesn't have any friends. It's okay, you know.
Yeah.
Well,
and
you
she
know.
And she comes in while Allie is crying over her boyfriend and, like, comforts her and tries to cheer her up. And so that becomes the basis for why she becomes the new roommate.
Mm-hmm.
And so slowly things start to become strange. So like Hedy, for example, buys a puppy. Well, says she found the puppy, but bought like a $700 puppy. And there's a scene where they're like laying in bed and cuddling with the puppy. And, you know, then Hedra, as you mentioned, undresses frequently in front of Allie.
Yeah.
And seems very comfortable with doing it. And so these kind of different elements keep coming up. And there's, as Hedra becomes more difficult and overdramatic and more possessive, and actually in some way, Hedra's right. And when she first takes the apartment, she says, you know, please don't tell me that. Are you sure you're done with your fiancé? It's not going to be fair if 3 months from now you get back
to
your fiancé.
Yeah.
And I have to. So in a way, like, Hedra predicts what happens. Hedra knows what's going to happen. And in a way, initially, you're like, yeah, I get it. Like, Hedra should be upset. Like, she's been trying to be an awkward friend. Like,
an
she's
awkward friend?
Awkward.
I think, though, it's too awkward too soon. Again, I think part of the gay panic is that we realize, again, oh, there's something wrong with that Hedra. There's something wrong with her. Like, throughout. And yes, she is, in a way, screwed over. But even when that happens, you're sort of like, yeah, they need to get rid of her. Like,
yeah.
You are rooting for Bridget Fonda to get that roommate out.
Well, and there kind of interesting things happen after that. So, like, she does, Allie does reunite with Sam, which, why? Because he was crappy. But she reunites with him. And then Hedra starts really openly flirts with Sam. Is like,
yeah, I think that's the other part about, like, yeah, she definitely goes to
these kind of different places with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then she does, as we said, get to the point where she starts to completely look like Allie, dresses her way, has the same.
And uses that to get access to Sam.
Yep.
And there's a scene that happens where Sam is confused, and then he's not confused, but things happen anyway, and then more things happen. And so, yeah, I think there's the gay panic element of it. There is also, like, I mean, it's like that Jack Nicholson movie, The Passenger, right? Where it's like, can you truly take somebody's identity, and what happens if someone truly takes your identity, which is also a Hitchcockian element of the film.
And then, of course, we end up having Allie find out that Hedra has like a sister who died mysteriously, a twin sister who died mysteriously,
and that
she follows her to a sex club where there's definitely weird things happening in the sex club, and Allie is just like, you know, of course, very pure. So she runs out in disgust from this sex club. And so you get all these other hints that there's something wrong with Hedra.
And of course you also get, I mean, in terms of just dopey tropes in film, the, like, I'm going to keep newspaper clippings that allude to my crimes in a box in the closet trope.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of works in Misery, but, you know, it's like, we need exposition. I know. What if this person saved the newspaper clippings of the horrible things that they did? And puts it in a really easy to find but somewhat private place.
But we have to say there's this, like, cheesy voiceover at the end where it's like, you know, that Hedra never fully recovered from the accidental drowning of her sister, and she was lonely. And it's like, no, it seems like she killed her sister. Let's just she killed her sister. But, you know, so then Allie, of course, there's a on the news, someone dies at the hotel Sam's staying at. She rallies with Sam, realizes what Hedra did, and then there becomes this whole cat and mouse thing of now Hedra kidnapping Allie and trying to force her.
And now that we have to go on the run because I look like you, so you're going to go to jail, so you have to be with me now, which is like four-dimensional space chess.
And we should also mention, so Allison's best friend is Graham, who is a gay actor who lives on the floor above her.
Yes.
And he has a confrontation with Hedra and is, like, knocked out for, it seems like, days.
Yes, it is for days. He's in the bathroom unconscious for days.
Like, for days.
And does not wake up in a puddle of his own waste.
No.
And just fine. Right when you need him to wake up in that movie. I mean, again, I think there's elements of really bad writing where, again, it can't seem convenient. It can't seem like, almost like the old Batman comic, you know. He just happened to put the can of shark repellent on his tool belt. The episode, they end up in the water full of sharks. It just so happens the shark repellent's there. In some ways, yeah, Nick is shark repellent. In the way that he comes back to after several days of unconsciousness.
Yeah. But, so the other thing that also happens is this in this scene is that Hedra does get to the point because Allie keeps trying to escape and does stuff that she's going to kill her, and so Allie kisses her. And that kind of, you know, Hedra is like, oh, is thrown off, and then make these plans to buy plane tickets and run away together, but...
And pretend that they're running away together.
And then there's, you know, so then there's the epic battle and this chase and the convenient meat hook.
Yes, there's a very convenient meat hook that Hedy needs when she needs a weapon, and just so happens, you open a closet door and there's a meat hook there. It's fine.
It works.
I will say there is not to give too much of the film away, if you do want to sit through this thing, in just infinite Gen X generational narcissism, I guess you can sit through this film, but there's a couple red herrings where I thought, you know, there's a couple shots of stuff like, oh, the big drama, the big traumatic finale is going to be this, and it's not.
Yeah.
But yeah, cat and mouse game in an old New York City, pre-gentrified New York City apartment building, and of course there's a creepy basement, there's elevator play.
Just like Dress to Kill.
Actually. Just like Dress to Kill.
So it's this almost like, you know, we don't know what is Hedra's issue, and so, you know, now they're saying it was probably borderline personality disorder, and that she was assuming the identity of another person because of how weak her identity was. But for, you know, you're right. I think it's gay panic. Like, I think it's just gay panic. And
which I think is how people perceived it and how people got pulled into this movie, and I will say, being a college student in a single-sex dorm in the 90s, people who I think should have known better and friends of ours had even would say gay panic sort of things. Like, somehow there was a direct line between queerness and violence.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like straight out of that film Cruising and a couple other things.
Yeah.
Where, and that's a big part of the tension. I put tension in scare quotes, though this is an audio only podcast. I'm making quote symbols with my fingers right now as I say this. Yeah. Part of that tension, or a big load of that tension, is carried by this fear of gay people.
Yeah,
and that somehow same-sex attraction is inherently violent, inherently dangerous if you're the subject of it, which... in the 90s, we thought we were so sophisticated and smart and more progressive than those stupid boomers. But actually, we didn't go that far. And which is why I said early on, you know, I would say this phrase, oh, she's being very single white female about things.
Yeah.
And then realizing that actually just, again, the big load of tension in this film is gay panic tension. And,
yeah, and I think, you know, Raising Kane, Dressed to Kill, which were two big Brian De Palma films, that's exactly what happens in those films.
I mean, and that goes back to Rope as well, if you want to think about this, the straight line of the suspense thriller back to Hitchcock, so we can go from single white female to De Palma to Hitchcock in three hops.
You know, and you're right. I mean, we had, like, you know, you had a friend who was not a very attractive person, let's just say that, who was, like, nervous that a rumored gay RA might get him in the bathroom. And
or, well, he had I had locked that person out of our shared dorm room.
Oh.
And he needed the RA to unlock, they needed to find the RA while he was wearing a towel.
Just
to think, and was just nervous that this guy was going to do something.
Yeah,
I had to go to his room, and I mean, he wasn't, like, he was not being facetious. He seemed to be genuinely disturbed by the thought of, you know.
Well,
again,
we had a situation where we had a friend of ours stay for a couple weeks with us, and I had a family member who was like, "But he's gay. Aren't you nervous that he's going to do something to Matt?" And it's like, no, like, literally.
Yeah, no.
That's,
I mean,
not,
it's
how it works, right?
It's like, not how it works. I mean, and it's a concept that goes, I mean, again, the DSM, what, in 1970 still. You know, it was finally was the change that homosexuality was not some kind of psychological deviancy.
Yeah.
Not that people don't believe that, but, you know, it's, I think, again, you know, for young people today and my students, you know, we are currently in one of my classes reading the wonderful novel Tender by Belinda McKeon, and there's a homosexual character there who was there in Ireland in the 90s, only 4 years after Ireland decriminalized homosexuality.
Yeah.
And we had a very real conversation about what it means to be gay in a heteronormative society, about what kind of microaggressions, what kind of weird invisible tensions do you know, if someone finds out you're gay, are they going to be okay with it or not, you know? All of that weird tension that people have to carry in them is kind of still with us. But for my students, it seemed really foreign and weird.
Yeah.
Like, wow, yeah, people are still like that? That's weird. I don't get it. As opposed to in the 90s, you could be center-left, sophisticated, and cosmopolitan, and still fall for this movie.
Yeah.
Which is weird, and I would say in our evolution of cinematic literacy and its overt subtlety and its clunky writing, and I mean, one of the things is if you read the back of the DVD, or sorry, Blu-ray, Laserdisc sleeve, one of the big things they talk about is the spooky lighting. And that they did a lot of work doing the lighting of this, which they do, and maybe it's an exercise in style in the lighting.
Yeah.
But you could almost, if there was not this gay panic homophobic thing in it, you could almost enjoy this film as kitsch.
Yeah.
In 2021. You'd be like, oh, look how stupid people were once. Yeah. You know, and kind of do a riff tracks on it. But, man, I don't know.
No, I mean, I agree with you, and I think the rap is where I read the article on the 25th anniversary of Single White Female, and them just mentioning that Hedy is the perfect monster because she passes as straight.
Yes.
And so she's a liar, she's a traitor, she passes as straight, so on multiple levels, she betrays Allie.
Yes.
And so that's kind of actually what the fear plays on.
Yeah.
But, you know, but anyone who's had a roommate, anyone who's had to live with a person, there is something strange about living with another person, right?
Living with another adult, yeah.
And trying to find out about that person, and you learn about their quirks.
Their foibles and their quirks, and there's a point where you stop being visitors and you just become the person.
And so, like, there's actually... So, like, they actually didn't have to go down that charged route because... of the gay panic, because there actually is enough panic in bringing a stranger into your home and trusting that stranger and then learning about that stranger. And there's these awkward moments. Like, Bridget Fonda, Allie is caught going through Hedra's stuff. You know, and of course, Allie catches Hedra stealing some of her clothes, you know, and so there's just like these weird little things happen. Allie walks in on, or kind of hears Hedra masturbating and peeks into the room. And so there's like these weird things that definitely happen when you have roommates that no one wants to talk about.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like, I remember my poor brother had a roommate who would hear him masturbate all the time. And it was just like,
and hell is other people.
Hell is other people. And no one ever talks about how weird that can be of having these other people in your life. So I think there was enough fodder there without having to bring in the gay panic element to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, but Basic Instinct, two women kissing, brings in, at that time, brought in the audience.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the voyeurism is why someone would pay the equivalent of $74.
Yeah.
to watch this movie as many times as they want. And, you know, Laserdisc, you can pause, you can stop, much clearer than VHS.
So we were joking with our friend that Laserdisc at that time had this more prestige element.
Yes, it was the cinephile, you know, it was the cinephile format, I think. And if really people watched it on Laserdisc, it would have this better, more thing. Or as you watch popcorn movies on VHS or something.
Yeah.
Which again is just hard to imagine.
Yeah. So, this is definitely a problematic film.
Yes. So, I guess we got to talk about our four big questions, including our brand new fourth question. Is a camp retro classic or just an old movie? Question one.
I think it's just an old movie.
Yeah, it is just an old movie. It's a piece of 90s... I guess, to understand the 90s, this is maybe an important film for that. But if you're not teaching or taking a special topics course called America Before the Millennium or something in a college in a college grad student seminar, there might not be a reason to watch this movie.
Yeah.
Unless you do, again, want to see how, you know, if you want to update the celluloid closet, if you want to do research, I mean, this is a movie for grad students, I think. Not that we weren't both grad students at some point, but... that's the best audience for this movie at this point.
And it might have been a forgotten movie in terms of doing queer research around it. There didn't seem to be a ton
lot. Yeah. And other than just being, everybody gets what this movie's about. Everybody who was alive at that time knows the plot because the plot's kind of in the title. It kind of, in their sense, what the premise is. So... we've been talking about it all episode, but question two about that social political distance.
So funny, like the Bechdel test, right? Like, is that how you say it? I'm so sorry. Is that the funny part is like it's these two women living together, and they spend the vast majority of the time talking about Sam and how bad that relationship is. So that part had me laughing. because I was like, oh, you have these two women living together, but it seems like almost any time they have a conversation, it's about Sam.
Yes, not the puppy.
Not the puppy. Not Sam. Not your career. Like, it's about Sam. And then there is an attempted sexual assault in that they do, of course, like, talk about that. But it turns back to Sam, like, why wasn't Sam here to protect you? Or yes. Why wasn't Sam here to help you? So it always just goes back to Sam, yes. Which I thought was really, really fascinating. The other funny part is the, there is the answering machine. That's how Allie hears.
Well, about, so that's question three. That's the technical distance question.
But I think in the sense of, like, you know, we talked about the gay panic. But that also, like, two women living together would not spend
all of their time
talking about Sam, right? Yes. Like, that's literally what happened in the film.
So question three, this technical distance, so there's answering machines. The one that, for me, was laughable, because there's this new, like, so the Allie character, she works on these things called computers.
Yes.
Which is very futuristic.
Yes.
Remember when computers were all beige? And they're Macs, though. They're Macs. Those are Mac graphics. And there's a scene where, because the scuzzy Ned the Head character, guy played by Ned the Head, character, tries ripping Jennifer Jason Leigh's character off, there's a moment where the data in the computer system starts to disappear, and there's a pop-up window that just says "lost!" exclamation point when all of the data is deleted, which is so hilarious. I mean, it's again, it's older people who aren't familiar with computers, not understanding how that worked, and not thinking like, "Well, it's not on paper, so it's not real." Kind of anxieties. But then they have a pop-up window that just says "lost!" exclamation point is kind of laugh out loud funny at that moment in the film.
And so the funny part about it is, like, you don't know what her software program is until that moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looks like it's like a billing software or something. Prior to that, you think it's actually like a designing software.
That software is all things to all people, I think.
But I will say, it does have a virus in it, right? So she does set up a virus that if you don't pay...
Yes.
That's right.
But the virus then also says, "Lost! You lost
it'll,
everything!"
It'll alert you to it. You lost everything. Yeah, the other funny part about it is that they're ordering tickets online, and so Hedger's like, "You can order tickets through the computer." Like, that was, like, the funniest part to me.
I don't think there's any dial-up noise anywhere.
No, there wasn't any of the annoying.
You got that right. So, question four, the new question four, the big one. Will we ever watch this movie again?
No. I feel like... So, going back to kind of question one, like, I think there is a fascination in the closeness that women can have and the toxicity at times that can exist in those relationships, right? Like, if you have a bad female friendship, how draining and difficult that can be, right? So I also think that's, like, an interesting avenue it could have taken.
Yeah.
That when you feel betrayed by the person that you really feel closest to. And, of course, Allie says, like, Hedra has no friends, but she has, you know, Allie has Graham and Sam. Like, that she doesn't seem to have any other female friends besides Hedra.
Yeah.
But if you want to, like, for me, the better film is Jennifer's Body, which I think Jennifer's Body now is being revisited. And I think with, you know, there was this a lot of Megan Fox backlash because Megan Fox was doing interviews, kind of being upset about how she was being treated on, you know, films and people kind of being saying that she's, you know, a prima donna, and now our kind of ideas of how women should be treated have evolved. And so I think there's a lot of backlash around Jennifer's Body. I think Jennifer's Body is the better film. If you want to see toxicity in a female relationship or how a female relationship could go bad, see Jennifer's Body. I didn't realize, because it's been such a long time, I certainly watch this. I'm a huge horror film fan. I love scary movies. I love thrillers. I certainly watched this. I probably watched it multiple times in the 90s. I haven't, though, probably watched it in 20 years. And so I just happened to see it, and I was like, through our pile, and I was like, oh, let's check this out. I haven't watched it in forever. It is so problematic. It feels so icky now. I don't necessarily, unless we were doing some conference paper or something,
there's
revisit it. How about you?
No, I never will see this movie again.
Yeah. It's like, for me, like, I adore Dress to Kill years and years, you know, in the 80s when I first saw it. Now it's so problematic to me.
I think that's the big thing about, you know, us doing this podcast and doing a retro movie podcast. It is, and I think this movie fits at the intersection of both of these things, to revisit a film from the VHS era. How has our social consciousness evolved and gotten better?
Yeah.
And maybe how have we gotten a little smarter about other people?
Yeah.
And two, how has our cinematic literacy just gotten better? Because we've just seen better, more sophisticated, smarter movies. Which, yes, people saw Hitchcock and learned things. And they did things maybe a little better in the next generation. And well, maybe now, you know, people who saw Single White Female when they were in film school are making much better movies now.
Yeah.
Because they know, it's like, I could do it better than that. I don't have to have a stupid plot.
Right.
And so both of these tensions, I think, really intersect in this film.
Yeah. And also, just because someone had one or two really good films doesn't mean all of their films are good.
Can't all be winners.
Can't all be winners.
And on that happy note, that's it.
All right.
Bye.